We are the space robots. We are here to protect you. Back, Chewie, us. Back, Chewie, us. Back, Chewie, us.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Pusher Robot.
And this is the Shover Robot.
And we are here to protect you from the terrible secret of space.
That's right. And this week, the terrible secret is extraterrestrial resources.
Damn right. Extraterrestrial resources are kind of where it's at right now. So first, what we'd like to talk about tonight is the companies that are involved with extraterrestrial resource acquisition. The most obviously named and biggest one, of course, is Planetary Resources.
That's right. Planetary Resources, which was announced April 2012 with Eric Anderson and Peter Diamandis. I've probably just butchered his last name, so if you're listening, Peter, please don't be upset at me.
Please don't judge us.
Don't judge us, please. Most notable for their crowdfunding, I think they were one of the third all-time best Kickstarter campaigns, where they basically reached down to the grassroots community, as much as grassroots as you can online, to try and fund their Arctic telescope that they tried to launch. They got big investors. They've got several different cool, very interesting people across their board of directors, like James Cameron and such. Basically, what Planetary Resources is trying to do now is find these asteroids and mine them. And I know that kind of makes a lot of sense. But the way they're going about it, first off, is by launching these little itty-bitty telescopes so that they can try to figure out what the heck is out there, where it is, and how can we get there.
Yeah, and I know that they've got the Arkid 3R is their satellite. Went up last month now, I suppose, to the International Space Station where it's awaiting deployment under the ideal conditions. And I guess, from what I read, the thing's like the size of a loaf of bread. And I know it doesn't have all the instruments on it. It's just, you know, kind of like the test model to make sure that all of the onboard systems and the fail-safes and such are working before they, you know, start flinging these things into the asteroid belt. Trying to latch on to some things and see what they can find. But we're getting pretty close, aren't we?
We certainly are. And it's interesting, too. I mean, the ARCA 3R, the R stands for the reflight, because the first mission in October, I was on an Antares rocket and it went off, kind of just blew up on the pad. That made me really sad because I had personally some investment into that satellite's build. Luckily, they were able to get it up there now with the Dragon. yeah.
Yeah, SpaceX is a great program. I'm really glad that we're getting a lot of private sector launches. That's definitely the future of it, especially with all the budget cuts that NASA's getting. And, mm-hmm. you know, other countries are also kind of turning an eye away from the sky, focusing on mm-hmm. more domestic issues. But
certainly.
So once we get these things up there, obviously they've got to go somewhere to mine the resources. So of the classifications of places that they can go, I know that our first and foremost, which of course is the thing that we've always wanted to reach since the dawn of time, is the moon. And
oh, yes.
There's a lot of resources on the moon, isn't there?
Oh, there's quite a plethora of resources on the moon. the most notably, of course, if you've been in the popular culture or read a lot of science fiction, they talk a lot about helium-3. And helium-3 is an isotope that's pretty much what is, you know, hybrid technology for gasoline engines, or flex fuel, you might say, to fusion engines. It makes things actually be able to work efficiently and economically. Basically, helium-3 allows the fusion reactors not to completely disintegrate themselves during their operation. But that's all over the moon because it comes from the sun. And guess what? The solar wind has just been depositing it on the moon for the past 4.5 billion years, and it's just been sitting up there collecting helium-3. I was going to say dust, but I mean, really. I mean,
helium-3
it is space
dust,
kind of. Helium-3 dust. That's right. Yeah, it's pretty great.
And I guess,
not going to lie.
I guess fueling really is the issue, because, I mean, when you think about it, you've got to have fuel to take off from the Earth or whatever launching platform you're using, get you up to speed, and then you have to turn around and use fuel again to land you onto the moon. So you need the fuel to take off, the fuel to land, and then you need the fuel to retake off. And I guess if you're using a craft that's got a heat shield, you got to have some braking before you enter the atmosphere, but a lot of it's atmospheric braking.
Right.
But if we could fuel up on the moon, then you're basically knocking out a third of that. I mean, well, less than a third, because, you know, Moon has a lot less gravity than the Earth. But the fuel that you use to slow down and land is the same space that you'll refuel up and take off. So that leaves a whole lot more room for cargo or personnel, or additional, you know, scientific equipment.
Or just a smaller rocket launched from Earth, too. You know, you're saving money trying to get that up in the space.
Oh, come on, Trevor. Bigger is better. You know that.
Of course.
So, I mean, other than fuel, which is probably one of the first things that we'd want to find, just for short-term missions, in the longer term, do you think it's possible to produce oxygen and some of the other necessary fabrication materials from resources we can find on the moon?
Absolutely, and there was a really great breakthrough in finding that there is indeed water ice at the poles of the moon. And that, of course, you know, water, H2O, hydrogen, oxygen are the basic components of most modern rocket engines. So, I mean, you know, you look at the space shuttle when it took off, it's that big orange tank that it lifted off with was, you know, two-thirds of it was a giant hydrogen tank and one-third of it was a giant oxygen tank. And yeah, that's how that sucker got up into the air, besides the two solid rocket boosters.
It's one big water bottle, is what you're telling me.
Yep, and you know, hey, it's good for carbon emissions, right? Because there are none. It's just hydrogen and oxygen, you know, just water vapors shooting out the back of a space shuttle.
Yeah, and from what I've seen from the processes that they're describing in these scientific journals about producing oxygen on the moon, a lot of it has metal byproducts. Possibly not, you know, a lot of it's useful metal byproducts, but certainly we could use some of that to construct at least basic, you know, shielding on the moon for space habitats or some such thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the first space habitats on the moon that are designed for any sort of length of time for staying there is going to be underground. And but what you're talking about is using it, getting it out of the volatiles out of the lunar surface and through the regolith. Mm. And there's some really cool chemical processes that you can use to extract oxygen out of just the lunar dust. The fancy term is regolith, but it's so hard to say sometimes.
Yeah.
So does it make you sound smarter if you say regolith instead of just dirt, space dirt?
You know, if it makes me sound smarter, I'll go ahead and say it all day. But dirt.
There's that. That's going to get you going pretty well. And I got to give a shout out then to Deep Space Industries. That's another huge corporation, or not huge corporation, I guess. Huge corporations for space resources right now are pretty small, but they're the other major contender that at least has been made a public announcement. They were announced on the 22nd of January in 2013. But their whole big deal is going to be manufacturing, refueling, and retrieval. And instead of this whole telescopes and you know, little prospecting missions at planetary resources just focusing on, DSI has actually been really doing a lot of research into manufacturing things in space and trying to figure out how to refine and refuel spacecraft and materials from either the lunar surface or from asteroids and whatnot. But we'll get into that in a second, I'm sure, here.
Yeah.
Yeah,
darn right, but we will. This is extraterrestrial resources. This is excellent.
We're gonna talk about asteroids. It's going to be a good time. But I can't, I can't discount NASA completely, because they're actually also helping pave the way for all this to happen. I mean, in 2005, we had that Comet rendezvous mission with Deep Impact.
Mm-hmm.
2016, next year, we're going to have the asteroid sample return mission from OSIRIS-REx. And right now, you know, that's pretty much the farthest out that they've gone with the sample return missions. So that's going to be pretty cool to see, and hopefully we learn some nifty things about asteroids and whatnot.
Yeah, I sure hope so. Yeah, it's certainly an exciting time. As much as I'd like to be optimistic about mining on the moon, I know that there are at least a couple of problems, one of which being the dust that I know causes a huge, you know, jam up in pretty much anything that has a moving part that we put on the moon. And I just don't know if we have enough WD-40 to fix it all.
We certainly don't. But, you know, the dust in and of itself, though, you know, when they went to the moon for the Apollo missions, they were restricted basically to those couple of days that they were there. And if they had wanted to stay any longer, their suits would have started seizing up something fierce, just like you said. But as far as the dust is concerned, you know, proper decontamination procedures using electrostatic, because one of the reasons that dust is so it sticks to everything is because it's electrically charged due to the ionization of the regolith from the solar wind. And so basically all you need to do in that point is charge yourself up and just discharge the charge that you've received. Just, you know, how, you know, when you're a kid, you're rubbing balloons on your head and sticking them to the wall and such. It's the same concept, so you just got to dispel that charge and you're good to go.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that in and of itself, though, that property of the dust clinging to things might actually be one way we go about harvesting the lunar regolith using some electrostatic procedures.
Yeah, true. But all that static cling to use.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's the moon. Looking a little bit farther out or closer in, you know, depending on the time of the year, is near-Earth asteroids, or NEAs. And those, as I understand, hold a wide range of different things that we could mine, since each asteroid, you know, predictably came from a different source, or at least groupings of them came from different sources. And so while some of them might have ice cores or something, other ones might have light metals, even heavy metals, depending on where they were ejected from. And
Heavy metals.
And from their last count, they had something along the lines of 70,000 near-Earth asteroids that are greater than 100 meters in diameter, making them perfect targets. And these near-Earth asteroids come in range about every 2 to 4 years. At least one of them comes in that we could launch a mission. And, mm-hmm. you know, what do you think about our feasibility of, you know, snatching one of those, since it's not exactly a stationary target, per se?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you know, all comes down to orbital mechanics and energy levels. And I'm not going to get too into the in-depth of that, into the weeds of it. But suffice it to say that some of these asteroids, these near-Earth asteroids, they actually have a lower energy state than the surface of the moon. So it'll actually take less delta V, which is essentially fuel and power for launching rockets, to get to the asteroid than it would be to get to the surface of the moon. And that's kind of interesting when you think about that, because you think about, oh, but the asteroid, it's way, way out there. But if you time it just right and you use your burns at just the right moment, you can develop trajectories basically to get to there really, really cheaply. So it's easy to get there, some of these ones. That's not going to be the hard part.
Yeah, I'll leave that to you. I was never any good at Kerbal Space Program, so they wouldn't get much good input from me. So
yeah.
Obviously, you know, near-Earth asteroids would require some capture, and we'd have to bring them into something of a stable orbit unless our mining missions were real quick, or unless we were willing to leave our mining equipment on the asteroid as it did its pass around the sun and just caught it on its way back. Obviously, I think that our best solution here is to capture one and bring it into orbit around Earth for proper mining procedures. And I know
okay.
NASA was on track to do an asteroid capture, but I believe that it was caught up in legislation recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the last thing I heard about that is they're now going to just do a snatch and grab. They're just going to go and bring a little tiny bit, little chunk of an asteroid back. Yeah.
Yeah,
NASA,
anything's
a start. That's the one downside to NASA is that it is subject to the whims of the political entities that be.
Indeed. Well,
but yeah, I mean, up at the asteroids, you've got all sorts of really great things up there. Platinum group metals is going to be huge because we don't have a lot of those on the Earth, and that's going to be your ruthenium, rhodium, palladium, osmium, iridium, platinum. I'm sorry, platinum.
Hey, we could have British listeners. They could like platinum.
Platinum. Anyway, but you're also, yeah, just like you said, all sorts of different things. You're going to have water, and there's just a multitude of different types of asteroids. I mean, you've got like chondrites, carbonate chondrites and such, and gosh, I could say some other fun names, but I, for the love of me, can't remember what they're called right now. Suffice it to say that they're extremely geologically diverse, and that's, you know, back to planetary research using their telescopes trying to figure out which ones we should go to. They're looking for the ones that they can make a bigger return on. And I really think that the first ones are going to be which ones have high water content, because that's relatively easy to bake out of it using heat at the asteroid. Just kind of, if you would, cover the asteroid with some sort of plastic bag. It doesn't have to be a large asteroid now. I mean, you don't have to think of the ones the size in like Armageddon,
yeah.
You know, the size of Texas. But just like one the size of a minivan, or maybe even the size of a sofa or a bunk bed couch. You know, you then heat that up. You can get the volatiles to bubble up and out, evaporate, and then you just capture those and make your fuel on site or cart them off somewhere else. But PGMs, back to PGMs, those suckers, really rare on Earth. We're apparently going to hit a shortage here, from what I understand. I was doing some research on this earlier. And the funny thing is that most of the PGMs have been hypothesized to come from asteroidal impacts on the Earth. Hmm. So that's where they're coming from. And so we need to go get more. We have to go get more asteroids. And definitely don't want to have to wait for another asteroid to come hit the Earth and give us more PGMs. So I think going out there is a much better option.
Yes, please don't call us. We'll call you.
Yes. Which is, hey, you know, that's another reason, though, that getting out there to the asteroids and doing these mining technologies is kind of important. Another good motivator is because, shoot, we don't want Armageddon to happen here. I mean, you know, you had the that Russian event where the asteroid or meteor just kind of broke up right above a city, you know, caused a lot of broken windows and scared a lot of people. I think that was kind of a wake-up call for the world. The Tunguska event, too. Shoot, that sucker at right at the turn of the century.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people thought an atomic bomb went off. And, you know, you think about something like that, and had that happened, you know, 30, 40 years later during the Cold War, you know, something of that magnitude going off, I'm sure that the Russians would have thought that we had nuked them, and then they would have retaliated. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that could go wrong with stuff coming in from space.
Yeah, we've got enough problems without space igniting World War III right on top of us.
Yeah, that would not be good. But, I mean, NASA's identified over 1,000 potentially dangerous near-Earth asteroids. And when I say potentially dangerous, it means that they've got some astronomically good odds. And by astronomically good odds, I mean like one in 25 hundred thousandths of a chance of hitting the Earth. And, you know, put that in perspective, though. I mean, it sounds like it's pretty far out there, but winning the lottery is like one in 258,800,000 something chance of winning the lottery. So, I mean, you have a better chance of getting hit by an asteroid than getting hit by the lottery.
You really know how to cheer me up, don't you, Shover?
But no, it's okay because, you know, by putting these, putting our resources into developing our mining technologies for going off into space and mining these asteroids is really going to help protect us in the long run. So it's a double win. You go out there, you win, get some asteroidal material, you make a profit, and you know if something comes up and you're like, hey, this asteroid's going to come hit us in like 12 years, you'd be like, all right, we'll just go out there and we'll change its course a little bit, just a little bit. It won't take a lot as long as you have a large enough look ahead of time.
Yeah, very true. Small changes, long period of time makes for
absolutely
a happy orbit. That's for sure.
Yeah, at least one that doesn't hit the Earth.
Yeah, that's what I would consider a happy orbit. All right. So, outside of asteroids, the last major place that we have to look is, of course, our next door neighbor, and I don't mean Venus, because Venus would be an absolutely awful place to look for resources for a number of reasons. But Mars. Mars certainly has a lot of possibility for human habitation, not only for it being, you know, the only other planet that we're talking about at the moment, but for having you know, readily available water in ice form and some materials in its thin but still there atmosphere that could be useful to us, like carbon dioxide and nitrogen and argon in various mm-hmm. quantities.
Absolutely. I mean, you think about going to Mars and how expensive that project's going to be. We're you know, hundreds of billions of dollars on a round-trip ticket to Mars if we bring all of our stuff with us. And you can substantially decrease that if, when you get to Mars, instead of having I've already had to bring all the fuel with you to give for the return trip, that you just make your fuel there. Or what's more likely is that we send out something ahead of time that's going to start making fuel so that we have it when we get there. And that's a huge, huge, huge plus. And you know, with the, you know, recent news, with more, we're finding more and more of a probability of there existing in some form water. We know it exists. There's water on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just myths anymore. We've seen its evidence. But hopefully, there's more than just in the permafrost. You know, we can get down maybe a little bit deeper. Maybe we'll find some aquifers or frozen aquifers. Maybe not. who knows what we might find if we put like a drilling rig or something there on Mars. But water is huge. Again, hydrogen, oxygen is used for fuel. Also, you're talking about, life support systems, oxygen, obviously, to breathe, and then water to drink. But also, as far as fuel goes on Mars, you're probably going to be using methane. There's I want to say it's called the Saboteur process, where you can take hydrogen and carbon dioxide, and with a nickel catalyst, you can make yourself some methane. And, people are like, oh, methane, though, that's like what? That's not a fuel, is it? I'm like, oh, yeah, it is. I believe the V2 rockets used methane, and that worked just well for them. Also, you think about different alternative fuel sources that we've used in the past. Alternative fuel sources, just different fuel sources. The first stage of the Saturn V was all kerosene. That sucker was pumping that stuff out at like 5 tons per second for that first stage there.
It'll get you there.
It'll get you there. The kerosene. Ah, it's got a nice smell to it when it burns. I love the smell of kerosene. Not gonna lie. Jet fuel.
Lovely smell of jet fuel in the morning.
Oh, jet fuel in the morning, really. Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, what I'm hearing, from research and from us talking is, of course, that Mars has, I think it has probably our best chance of more stable colonization. I mean, the moon's pretty good. It's got a lot of resources. It's also really close, pretty much instantaneous communication in a solar system sense anyway. It's been there. It's going to be there. But it seems like Mars gives us a really good opportunity to go out to a place where we have an atmosphere that we could possibly use to our advantage. We have resources that we may not know all of them right now, but it certainly has quite an abundance of materials that we could use. And we have still the possibility of producing propellants from that stuff, which is, I think, the basis of any mission that is going anywhere for an extended period of time, is a way to get back.
Yeah, getting back is kind of an important part. No one wants to be part of a... that's not true. I guess I can't say that because there was that whole, one-way trip to Mars thing going on. So I was going to say, no one wants to be part of a suicide mission. But I guess some people do. That's okay. I understand. You want to get to Mars. It'd be cool. But it's, it's really not the point of things. You got to get there and survive. That's the goal, is to, proliferate our existence in the solar system and not just say, hey, we touched it and that was it.
Yeah.
But, Mars would be great. And also, too, because it's got the same, or not the exact same, but a very, very similar day cycle, day-night cycle on Mars. I think it's 23-something-odd hours, plus or minus some change there. But it's very similar, and that's a psychological benefit to humans living there. Its gravity is a little bit lower, which makes things easier for us. It's not quite as low as it is on the moon. So you won't have as much of bone density and muscle mass loss, but you'll still have to, keep your exercise going. Needless to say, the resources on Mars will certainly go a long way if we're able to use those to making these missions, bringing them down from several hundreds of billions of dollars to maybe tens of billions of dollars in cost. And it's still a lot of money. But when you think about it, how much money do governmental agencies spend usually? And, you've got large companies making considerable chunks of change. So we really just, if we just galvanize our interest in space and we really, really push for it, I don't think that just on a cost basis alone, that something is impossible.
I would say not. Like, very much definitely something that we can get at least going within our lifetime. I hope that within a generation or two, we've got this kind of thing rolling because we are running out of stuff on Earth to use. And it looks like the stars are going to be our only answer to that problem.
Yeah. I mean, shoot, things on Earth, they're going to... Things are going to... It's going a little bit crazy. I don't think that we're going to completely run out of resources really, really soon. But the fact that we can get them from space, and not only can we use them to benefit things on Earth, but we can use them to build things in space, and at which point you've reached an amazing opportunity. Because when you stop having to hoist all of your resources out of the extremely deep gravity well of the Earth And that's relatively speaking. I mean, obviously, you know, you've got Jupiter, which is enormous, and the Sun. I don't even want to get there. But, you know, you've saved, I want to say, 3,000 meters a second in delta V by just having your things already up in space in low Earth orbit. You can then construct your vehicles and so and habitats and whatnot. You'll be able to drastically reduce the cost of doing business in space. And I think that that pushes mankind, at least as a springboard, into being a space-faring civilization. And that's pretty stinking exciting.
That is the goal.
That is something I think would be amazing. And I think that's necessary, too. I mean, you know, if you want to get to a scientific perspective of things, it's, you know, expand or die. Grow or die is kind of the law of nature. So if we as a human race want to, you know, proliferate our existence, we've got to get up into space. And there's some really cool things that we are going to get up there, and we're going to discover so many things that we didn't even know existed yet. I mean, that's kind of the whole topic of our podcast, isn't it?
Yep,
so,
pretty much.
Thus far. But yeah, space is a terrible power.
Darn
and
right.
It's beautiful.
All right, before we get finished up tonight, I want to talk a little bit about, we are talking about government, so we might as well talk about government in space. Last week, the House of Representatives passed the Space Act bill, which I have affectionately named Miners Keepers. The gist of the bill, of course, is that if you mine it from the solar system, then you own it. Which is, I guess, a neat way of dividing up and perhaps incentivizing countries and organizations to go out there and start mining extraterrestrial resources, since they pretty much get sovereign ownership to anything their drills touch. Do you think that's a good idea, a good way of going about it?
Yeah, I mean, really, you have to have some sort of legal protection for companies to want to be able to take that risk of getting out into space. I mean, if we didn't have this happening, this is amazing to see that it's actually coming through the governmental side of the house of things, because, you know, you get out into space, you spend all this money, or you want to do all these things, and you get there, and you can't say that that's your material, you're not going to have a lot of investors, and so that's going to really hamper the whole privatized spaceflight industry, and the whole point of space resources is, you know, you're going to have some sort of an economy that goes around with them, and I know, you know, this isn't quite set up all the rules for it, but at least it's better than what we have in the, you know, it was just out in the space treaty, which basically said that no nation can have, you know, can claim ownership to celestial bodies and stuff, you know, kind of similar to the laws of the sea and whatnot. But this is kind of putting down like some mineral rights. Like, hey, you can actually go out there and say this little hunk of mine, this little rock in space floating around, that's my rock in space, and I'm utilizing it. I think that's the smart way of doing it. It's saying, hey, if you go out there and you've got your equipment out there, that you're utilizing that material, that is now yours until you stop utilizing it. And I think it's a smart way too, because, shoot, kind of puts an incentive, a little bit of a gold rush, you might say. People want to go out there and stake their claim. You know, you got the space treaty of, gosh, I want to say it was 1975, but I honestly don't remember. But basically it said that, you know, if you've got your mission here doing something or other, you've got a 125-mile radius around you of a bubble that no one else can touch, because they would be interfering with your operations. And that was established for back in the day when we really didn't have quite as accurate of rockets and stuff to be able to get you within, you know, certain percentages and accuracies. So that you didn't want, you know, the Russians landing right on top of the Americans by accident kind of thing going on. So that's something to take away from that. You know, hey, if that's still a valid thing, if we launched a rocket or a lander or a rover on the moon, that whole spot within 125 miles is now ours. You can't touch it until we're gone.
Pretty much manifest destiny for the stars, I would say.
Yeah, certainly is. It's interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to seeing any additional regulation, especially following this bill, to see if it passes through the Senate and the executive branch, see if it gets signed into law, and see if the other nations cooperate as well. So a lot of exciting things happening, I would say.
Absolutely, positively.
All right. Well, I think that's about all we have time for tonight. So once again, I am the Pusher Robot.
And I'm the shovel robot.
And you have gone down the stairs.
Down the stairs.
I'm all about that space, about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, about that space.